This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, will the conviction of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin for the murder of George Floyd pave the way for sustainable police reform in America? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Almost 1 year after the white police officer, a 19-year veteran of the Minneapolis police force, knelt on the neck of George Floyd, a 46-year-old African-American, for 9 minutes and 29 seconds, resulting in Floyd's death, a jury convicted him on 3 counts of murder and manslaughter. Floyd's murder, caught on videotape by a 17-year-old young woman who testified along with many other bystanders in the Chauvin murder trial, sparked nationwide protests against excessive use of force and police brutality, especially against African Americans. The graphic video, poignant testimony of bystanders, medical experts, and most importantly, fellow police officers, including the Minneapolis chief of police, who denounced Chauvin's use of force as excessive and unnecessary, convinced the jury to render a guilty verdict. For a country whose legal system rarely holds police officers accountable for killing in the line of duty, especially when victims are Black, the case is seen as a milestone. But U.S. President Joe Biden, who spoke to the nation after the verdict, said Floyd's tragic death and Chauvin's conviction must move the United States toward greater accountability for police abuses and equality under the law.
No one should be above the law. And today's verdict sends that message. But it's not enough. We can't stop here. In order to deliver real change and reform, we can and we must do more to reduce the likelihood that tragedies like this will ever happen or occur again.
In that vein, Vice President Kamala Harris invoked the need for Congress to pass the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act. The bill has cleared the House of Representatives and is now awaiting action in the Senate.
Last summer, together with Senator Cory Booker and Representative Karen Bass, I introduced the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act. This bill would hold law enforcement accountable and help build trust between law enforcement and our communities.
The George Floyd Justice in Policing Act would ban chokeholds, end racial and religious profiling, eliminate qualified immunity for law enforcement, a concept we'll discuss in the show, establish national standards for police departments, and promote investments in community-based policing, among other vital changes. Analysts say that America must shift from the current warrior policing model to a so-called guardian model. Well, joining me to talk about prospects for long-term police reform in America in the wake of the Derek Chauvin verdict are two distinguished analysts who joined me via Microsoft Teams. Chuck Wexler is executive director of the Police Executive Research Forum, a Washington-based organization of law enforcement officials and others dedicated to improving the professionalism of policing. Mr. Wexler has been involved in crime reduction and policing projects in the United States and around the world, in Minneapolis, Kansas City, Los Angeles, Northern Ireland, Kingston, Jamaica, London, Tanzania, and the Middle East. And Ron Harris, he's a professor of journalism at Howard University here in Washington. He is also the co-author of the book, The Black and the Blue, A Cop Reveals the Crimes, Racism, and Injustice in America's Law Enforcement. Well, gentlemen, welcome to the program. Chuck Wexler, let me begin with you. What's your reaction to Derek Chauvin's conviction, and to what extent do you think it can be a catalyst for greater police reform?
A number of emotions. First of all, sympathy to the Floyd family. That's number one. I mean, the sanctity of human life is the most important aspect of all of our lives. And when it's taken so brutally, the best you can hope for is justice. You know, the reaction, honestly, is that justice prevailed, that the system worked, and there was a sense of relief. Honestly, police departments across the country and around the world, I might add, were all on high alert, because if the outcome was different than what we saw, we would know, based upon the last 11 months, that things would be very difficult in cities around the world.
Let me turn to you, Ron Harris, to get your take on whether or not you think the verdict can be an impetus to changing policing in America, which is, of course, what many are hoping that it will do.
Over the long history, we've seen cases like this happen, and they haven't necessarily led to significant police reform. When we go all the way back to Rodney King in Los Angeles in 1992, I was a journalist working for the Los Angeles Times at that point, and we thought that that would be a turning point, but it wasn't. I know as a black journalist, you say, wow, we've been talking about this, and here's the video. Now you finally see it. And if you recall, those officers weren't found guilty, even though there was video evidence of what happened, and they had to go to a civil rights case. So I'm optimistic. As Chuck can tell you, people have been out in the streets on this issue for 40, 50 years. If you go back, you can see the same similar kinds of signs. So I'm optimistic, but I don't necessarily see it as a turning point.
Turning back to you, Chuck Wexler, about whether or not this is an inflection point in America. Of course, no one single case will end systemic racism or stamp out excessive force in departments nationwide. But there's this analogy we talk about. Is it about a few bad apples, you know, people like Chauvin and others who have abused their authority? Or do you see a much more systemic problem in policing, which is the view of many? And if that's the case, whether it's passing the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act or any other reforms with regard to training, recruitment, use of force, how much of an uphill battle is this going to be?
From our perspective, we have been looking at the issue of use of force for 20 years. How the police use force is really what makes the police work so unique. The police have a monopoly on legitimate use of force, and how they use it, the challenges that police face, hasn't been understood. What has made use of force such a defining issue for the police is really one issue, and it sort of goes back to Rodney King, if you think about it. In the Rodney King video, which was 30 years ago, that was an individual who the police needed to arrest, and there was a lot of controversy about how he should be arrested and so forth. The long and the short of it is there was a videotape of the Los Angeles police arresting him. And I remember that that video went viral. Now, fast forward, say, 20, 25 years, and citizens began to have iPhones, and then suddenly police decided that they needed to have body-worn cameras. And what you began to see is an aspect of policing that the public really didn't see. Maybe you saw some of it, but now it's not unusual to see the police in some kind of situation daily. So the American people and police departments, I might add, are seeing an aspect of policing they never saw before. And so they're asking questions. Did the police need to use that kind of force? So in some ways, a gigantic microscope has been put on the police in terms of their tactics, their values, their policies, everything about how the police operate. And I think that is what we have to remember, is that as we're looking at these images, we're looking at their training, we're looking at their hiring, we're looking at their supervision, we're looking at all of these aspects, and underlying all of that, our values. My point in all of this is that in some ways, police training has to be turned upside down. Who we hire, we have to take a hard look at that. We also have to recognize that hiring is going to be more difficult, more challenging. People just aren't going to want to take these jobs. So I think this is an opportunity for the right reasons to re-engineer and rethink how the police do their work in the most humane way.
Well, how about that, Ron Harris?
No question. It is training. It is turning the police departments upside down. And I say that for a lot of reasons, not just about violence, dangerous police encounters, but the way we use police. I am appalled at these incidents. But at the same time, I look at the way we use police when we talk about crime, crime prevention, things like that. And then sometimes I look at it and I see police at the end of failing systems. I'm going to give you an example. Mental health. If I were a police officer, I would go to my union. I'd say, look, we're not going to handle any more mental health cases because they're outside of our purview. We are not trained to do mental health. It is a health care problem. It is not a crime problem. It is not a policing problem. It's not a law enforcement problem. But you're sending us out here to go out and deal with mental health cases. And when they go bad, we're the guys at the end of it. That's one example in which police are used incorrectly. But let me go back to what Chuck talked about, and I think he's 100% right. When I was covering a war in Iraq, I remember talking to a guy who had been in the previous Gulf War, and I asked him, I said, look, man, how do you go in and you're charging this building, they're shooting bullets at you, but you keep going. I just don't see how you do it. He said, Ron, you play like you train. He said, it becomes what you do. You've been trained so hard. This is how you respond. And I'll go back to what Chuck said, is there's a lot of ways that we can deal with issues, but the training has to be different. The mindset has to be different. The values have to be different. And that's why these incidents have happened year after year, decade after decade, over and over again. And even as we were going through the George Floyd case, even as that trial was going on, we still had incidents of people being shot. What's so amazing to me is that if you had a company and that division in that company racked up lawsuit after lawsuit, had problem after problem, you would go in and say, wait a minute, we cannot operate like this. We cannot have a company with this division. Let's take Minneapolis Police Department, for example. Just lost us $47 million in lawsuits. We can't do that. If you were a major firm, they would have gone in and said, we're going to flip this upside down because this just does not work. But we don't do that in America, and I don't understand that.
Well, speaking of that, the Justice Department, according to Attorney General Merrick Garland, in fact, is launching a civil investigation into the Minneapolis Police Department. So perhaps the equivalent of what you just said, we're going to talk about it on the other side of the break about what more can be done. But first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. Our guests are Chuck Wexler. He's executive director of the Police Executive Research Forum. And Ron Harris, from whom you just heard, he's a professor of journalism at Howard University and co-author of the book, The Black and the Blue. We're discussing the fallout from the verdict in the Derek Chauvin trial, how it could be a catalyst for much needed police reform and accountability in America. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Here's a shout out to one of our most loyal listeners, Evang Joe Kofi from Lafia in Nasarawa State, Nigeria. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to you, Chuck Wexler, to pick up where we left off about the need to almost reimagine policing in this country, perhaps more of a public safety paradigm. We know that ever since 9/11 terrorist attacks on U.S. soil, police departments have become much more militarized. Lots of military equipment, guns, we're a culture of guns. I mean, all of this must contribute to the violence, reaching for the gun as opposed to, let's say, a taser. And what about these so-called traffic stops? Even just recently, people being stopped, the pretext being a traffic stop, but usually they're black motorists. Chuck, what are you hearing and observing in police departments? Do you think change is afoot and are laws and reforms, as many of the states are implementing, going far enough? What else, you know, needs to be done?
Let me try to answer your question just stepping back a little bit, because I'm realizing you have an international audience. And because of that, I'm going to tell you a story that I think your audience can understand. I think a lot of countries look at the United States and they see what's going on and they wonder, why do we handle situations like they do? And for me, you know, who have worked around the world and I've had the opportunity and the honor to watch policing from different perspectives, I was in the United Kingdom. I was in Scotland during the Ferguson period, like about 2016, 5 years ago. And at the height of that period, I was working with Police Scotland. They were consolidating seven agencies. And I was at a recruit graduation. And it dawned on me as I was talking to a recruit, I looked at him and I said, well, how do you handle someone with a knife? And, you know, he said in a kind of English accent, no problem. I step back and I begin communicating and I have my baton and my spray, my Pava spray. And I thought to myself, well, wait a minute. He doesn't have a gun. And a knife situation in Glasgow and a knife situation in Chicago is still a knife. And in Chicago, they would use guns. And in Scotland, they don't have them. Or they do have them, but they keep them in a separate unit. And so that dawned on me that, is there a different way we can approach these situations where someone is in crisis, someone is suicidal, someone has a knife, someone has a rock? And so what we learned is you can de-escalate a situation that doesn't involve a gun. And basically, that's 40% of the Washington Post 1,000 cases. That's 400 a year, using time, distance, and slowing it down. And long story short, we took that back to the United States, and now we have implemented that kind of thinking and are now training. So until we began to rethink how we do things, police do what they do. Police get involved in shootings. Why? For a number of reasons, but one is that's how they're trained. So if we don't train them differently, don't expect different results. And I think that goes with a lot of things you were mentioning about situations, whether it's traffic stops or all of the other situations that police get in. We also use this term proportionality. If you look in the George Floyd case, what was that all about? It was about a counterfeit $20. Think about that. A counterfeit $20. No one would serve jail time for that. So the whole idea that you have to arrest someone, that you couldn't simply charge them and then give them a summons to appear or something like that. We're rethinking all of that. So I'm not sure I directly answered your question, but I thought for your international audience, they would find that interesting.
Absolutely. And before I turn to Ron, I just wanted to ask you very quickly, in terms of the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act, does that encompass that type of change in culture?
I think there's two different aspects of this. I think there's legislative reforms, and then I think there are local and decentralized kinds of issues. I think policing has to change from within. And then there are legislative ways that can be helped. For example, one of the things in that act that I do think is good is having a national database of officers who are problematic. I think that's really important. But I think the kind of changes I'm talking about, you can't legislate. You can't change culture by simply saying, okay, you can't do this, you can't do that. We need to teach police about values. We need to teach them about proportionality. We need to teach them about critical decision model rather than a use of force continuum.
Well, that's a very good point, but we still have the problem of a certain amount of systemic racism. So you stop mostly black motorists. We see a pattern of that here in this country, you know, at a traffic stop. And just like Chuck Wexler said, in the case of George Floyd, he had a counterfeit bill. We don't even know if he knew it was counterfeit, according to the cashier. How hopeful are you that in addition to legislation, that a new vision, a way of de-escalating, and like you said earlier, bringing in social services, healthcare, supplementing police with other types of service people who are more capable of handling a problem than the police? Ron Harris.
Well, I think Chuck hit really on a number of things that we talked about in our book. You have to change the culture, and you can't get it done until you change the culture. While we look at police on one hand and we say, well, we need a new police chief. To some degree, well, yes, we do need a police chief and we need a new attitude, but we also need some citizen involvement. And I'm not talking about citizen review boards. I'm talking about a relationship between police and communities. And I'm not even talking about necessarily community policing, but I'm really talking about an engagement between communities and policing and communities holding police departments accountable and also developing a relationship with police so the police understand that you're actually the guardian, you're not the warrior in this relationship. And until we have those kinds of things happen, nothing's really going to change. And you really need some systemic change. And we talked about training and really new ways of thinking. And when I talked about the mental health problem of supporting police, but again, as I said, holding police accountable, just that last point that you made, when we were working on the book, what broke my heart over and over again as I looked at these cases, so Chuck, he really hit it on the head. When you look at these cases, what are they about? People are dead for things that they would not go to jail for. They're small, small incidents. And that's, people are getting executed so that the officers have to think, wait a minute, I'm about to kill a guy, as he said, because he was drunk in a car. This is an example when he talks about a different way of thinking. In Atlanta, there's a man named Rashad Brooks. He fell asleep in a car. He was drunk. The police came. They had his car. They got him out of the car. They had got his driver's license, and he ran away. And a police officer chased him and shot him. And when you go back and think about it, you say, why? We have his car. We have his driver's license.
Right.
Where is he going? What is he going to do? He's going to call us in a few days and say, can I please have my car back?
Exactly.
And it's incident after incident like that. And as you get to these, you say, whoa, 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 we've got to rethink this concept that that person's life was more valuable to me than making that arrest, unless it is really a life and death situation for me or for another citizen. And that's not what we're seeing.
Exactly. Mr. Wexler, Chuck, what about briefly concepts like qualified immunity, which is a legal doctrine that shields police from liability, provides some immunity from civil suits? To what extent do you think that if that can be either eliminated or reduced, and then things like consent decrees, which you may want to define, which were rescinded under the Trump administration, which are back in use, I believe, for the Biden administration to hold police departments more accountable for their actions and to prevent patterns of discrimination and abuse.
And I will simply say that if you could take the lessons learned from consent decrees and you could somehow educate the 18,000 police departments in this country as to the findings, because the findings in, for example, New Orleans and Los Angeles and Chicago and Baltimore and Seattle, and what they prescribe is very similar. If you could take those lessons and you could say, you know what, here, American policing, here are the things that the Justice Department is concerned about. You need to know that you need to, say, develop an early warning system. You need to have a policy on use of force. You need to have accountability, transparency. You need to, you know, in terms of traffic stops, they have to be done in a constitutional way and so forth. That would really be a way to prevent incidents. The consent decrees, actually, in the whole Obama administration, they only did about 25 out of 18,000 police departments. So clearly, in the case of that individual department, sure, that's going to make a difference. But you have to ask yourself, if you're thinking nationally, legislatively, how do we best make a difference? I think we have to think about, what do we do on the front end? What do we do to change how people train, all of those aspects. So that's what I would say there, that we have to think a little differently. You know, the Justice Department Civil Rights Division, what they do is they investigate and they prosecute, and that's their job. There are other aspects of the government that could play a more preventive role and educate the community. I don't think a lot of these 18,000 police departments, of which 80% of them are under 50 officers, think about that. How do they learn about some best practices? How do they know, for example, with a taser, you should paint it a different color and you should have it on your weak side? They might read about that in the paper, but there's no national standards.
Well, that's what I'm thinking. You know, we need a multi-pronged approach. And even though you say that so many changes have to come from the grassroots, the communities, and the communities need to be involved, we still need some national leadership. So turning to you, Ron Harris, are you heartened by the fact that the Biden administration has restored the use of consent decrees? To what extent you think that could be helpful, as Chuck said, lessons learned that can be shared with these 18,000 police departments?
I'm very happy that Biden will be using consent decrees versus the Trump administration, which pulled back and even tried to cancel some of the consent decrees that were done under Obama. But I think while they are tools, what has to happen is a real cultural change regarding police and hiring and all of those practices. And it's really going to take, I think, the citizenry to demand those kinds of changes. Because as Chuck talked about, a lot of these departments are small. What happened, for instance, in Petersburg, Virginia, where the lieutenant in his uniform was pulled over and pepper sprayed, and you don't have to have a consent decree in that small police department. You got to have a cultural change, an attitudinal change. And that police chief has no remorse about what his officers did. That's really what it's about. It's an attitudinal change. Racism is part of it, but it's really systemic.
And on that note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Chuck Wexler, Executive Director of the Police Executive Research Forum, and Ron Harris, Professor of Journalism at Howard University and co-author of The Black and the Blue. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.